This is America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
John Florio joins us on Sports Byline. He's been with us before, and he was raised in Flushing, New York, and he credits the streets of Queens as one of the biggest influences in his life. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and his work has been seen on Vice and also in Sports Illustrated, and he has co-authored the book One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime, and this book highlights the intersection between American society and America's pastime during the 1960s when the hallmarks of the sport, fairness, competition, and mythology came under scrutiny. Now, you know, I read that where you said that one of the influences in your life was being raised in Flushing, New York. Explain that a little bit more to me.
Well, you know, Flushing, Queens back then was an interesting kind of area. It was a very insulated area, and it was one of those towns. It was a suburb, kind of a new suburb. It really kind of blossomed with the World's Fair coming into town. So it was a lot of young people, a lot of people my age hanging out. So even as a teenager, you know, there was always big groups of guys, big parties hanging out. But when I was younger, the way it relates to this book is that I was a baseball fan in the 60s. I was just a kid, and the 69 Mets won that year, and the whole town was going crazy. I mean, you know, that was really a miracle year. For listeners who weren't around back then, the 1969 Mets were really, truly an amazing story. I, however, was a Yankee fan. So for me, that was not the greatest moment of my life because, you know, at that point, you know, when you're like 7 or 8 years old, you're either a Yankee fan and you hate the Mets, or you're a Mets fan and you hate the Yankees. So I was actually rooting against the Mets in 69, I'm sorry to say, because now that I look back and we do some research on that team, we do quite a bit of talking about the 69 Mets in the book, I realize what like a great story it was and what underdogs they were. I wish I could go back because I love to root for the underdog.
You know, when I read the title of the book and I thought about the second part of that, how the 1960s collided with the national pastime, when I think about baseball and I think about all the different decades, you're absolutely right. The 60s probably more than any other decade, that was the case. You think about the 50s and Jackie Robinson and breaking the color barrier, but if you take the totality of the entire 1960s, it was a dynamic decade.
No doubt, Ron. You know, when Wheezy and I, the co-writer of the book is Wheezy Shapiro, by the way, and she's fantastic. And when we were sitting down and talking about what book we were going to do, we first started not with how the 60s collided with baseball, but we were interested in telling the Jim Boughton story. Because we said, you know, right at the end of the 60s, Jim Boughton came out with the book Ball Four. That was that first tell-all memoir that really told the inside story. There had been a couple of others, but they didn't really blow the locker room door off its hinges the way Boughton did. He is telling stories about Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford, and these guys are up on the roof of the hotel, of Shoreham Hotel in D.C., and they're looking into windows trying to see women on dress. I mean, this was salacious stuff, you know. And we said, well, you know, that's really an interesting story because at the beginning of the 60s, Jim Brosnan, another pitcher, had written a memoir. It was more innocuous. It was very interesting, and it told the life of a pitcher going through a very long season. He said, I drank a martini. And, you know, Major League Baseball was going crazy that he admitted he had a martini. And over the course of 10 years, we got to Jim Boughton. We said, well, what happened in the decade? Well, you start with Brosnan, you go through new journalism. There was some newspaper strikes. You go through the phase of new journalism of Gay Talese and Tom Wolfe and all of these guys. And what do you come out with? You come out with Jim Boughton. So we're thinking, well, this is a great story. But as we're thinking about it, we said, well, you know, that's not the only thing that happened in the 60s. That we just started in one point and you ended in another. I mean, the league unionized in the 60s, right? You start out, there was the reserve clause where players were slaves to you could never, nowadays, you're not a slave. Your contract runs out. You go to a different team. You make a lot of money. Back then, you were beholden to a team. If you didn't want to play for that team, you weren't going to play baseball at all. And then by the end of the decade, there's free agency just about around the corner, but the Players Association has unionized. Then we started thinking about race. Well, you know, yeah, Jackie Robinson integrated the game in 47, but in 61, teams were going down to the South, there was still segregation in Florida. The black players like Hank Aaron, Bob Gibson, they weren't allowed to stay with their team in 61. And then by 71, you've got the Pittsburgh Pirates fielding an all-minority lineup, 9 minority players on one lineup. So, I mean, all of those changes came, and you would think it hit us right, instantly, hey, let's do a book on the 60s. But then we were thinking, well, which one of these three things do we want to do? Do we want to do Boughton? Do we want to do race? Do we want to do unionization? And then we realized, wait a minute, this story is about the 60s. The hero of this story is not one person. The hero of this story, the person we're tracking, is a calendar page. And we went through the decade, showing how walls came crumbling down on many different fronts.
John, let me clarify something I might have said. I alluded to the fact about Jackie Robinson not breaking the color barrier in the 50s, but actually it was in the 40s as well.
Right.
Let's talk about what was going on in the 60s outside of sports and baseball.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're talking about, first of all, the assassinations, right? I mean, that's the first thing that I think of when I think of the 60s. I think of the Kennedy assassination, and I think of the Martin Luther King assassination, and, of course, Robert Kennedy as well. So there were those three biggest assassinations that happened. But you're also talking about the Vietnam War, right? You're talking about the draft. You're talking about, the Nixon-Kennedy debates, which were the first on TV. So you have the advent of television, which changed sports journalism, but we're talking about outside of baseball. It changed the culture, the American culture. It changed the American living room. Right, because you went from radio to TV. Baseball fans went from going to the park to see the game to staying at home and watching it. So these changes that were happened through all of society. And, of course, what we try to address is how they affected baseball, or in some cases how baseball affected society.
How did it change the game to any degree?
The changes I think the biggest change, really, is the unionization of the game. I mean, the game we know today, with baseball players making millions and millions of dollars going from team to team, and I'm saying that in a way, I don't mean that this is a negative thing, but the way we know the game and the way the game was at the beginning of the 60s really changed because of the Players Union and Marvin Miller starting taking over the Players Association in the mid-60s. So that's when it went from really an owner-run game to, I dare say, a player-run game now, but at least players have their own, have their union, and they have an equal footing to the owners. But that's the biggest, I think, change that had the longest-lasting effect. And how did the unionization come around? Well, that's, a reflection of society as well, because sooner or later, the game was going to get unionized. I mean, the unions were forming in Hollywood, unions, strikes were happening. We covered the New York newspaper strike in the book, but there are other sit-ins and strikes, and workers, students, citizens becoming more vocal. It only made sense that sooner or later the players were going to start becoming more vocal and standing up for themselves. But, of course, it all happened in the 60s because that's when this was in the public consciousness.
They talk about the Messerschmitt decision. That was very important, of course, with free agency and everything. But in about 2 minutes before we have to go to a break, I really thought the Curt Flood story is really one of the key moments in the change in baseball.
Sure. Well, that's really the same. When we talk about the unionization and the control going to the players, that really comes back to the Flood case. Marvin Miller took over the Players Association, and here's Curt Flood saying, well, I don't want to be traded to another team. I don't want to go to Philadelphia. And he goes to Marvin Miller and says, represent me. I don't want to go there. I want to challenge the reserve clause. I want to be able to say where I play. And that's that case. And Miller said, look, you're going to lose, but what you do may pave the way for the future. And that's what it ended up. They went from playing like slaves to playing as free people. I mean, that's his famous quote, right? Cosell asked him, Howard Cosell said, you make $1 million or whatever. He didn't make $1 million, maybe $100,000 a year. And Flood said, well, a well-paid slave is a slave nonetheless,
In about a minute before we break here, why do you think Curt Flood sacrificed himself?
Well, I think it was a couple of things. I think it took a certain person was going to do that. I think it was going to take a black player who you know, because they had suffered so many indignities that one who at that time in the late 60s, when race was in, when civil rights were an issue and players were starting to stand up for themselves, and it took somebody at the back end of their career. You know, Curt Flood was really on the far end of his career, and so he wasn't risking his entire future by challenging baseball. He was risking like a year or two, perhaps, of playing, but he was really at the far end. So it was the right guy with the right personality at the right time, and a guy who was pissed off enough to do something about it.
This is a fascinating book, and I hope you'll check it out because it'll give you insight beyond the playing field. It'll give you insight into society and the culture we happen to live in back in the 60s and how baseball kind of intersected with that culture at that particular time. We continue across the country and around the world. John Florio is with us as we move along here on Sports Byline.
This is America's Sports Talk Show. Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
John Florio has joined us here on Sports Byline. He has co-authored a great book called One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. And, you know, this book brings to life the seminal figures of the era, which includes Bob Gibson, Marvin Miller, Tom Seaver, and Dick Young, and it portrays their roles during a decade of flux and uncertainty. Give me a little more information about how they factored into this.
Well, you know, one of the names you mentioned there was Dick Young. And he was a really interesting character because he was kind of the old school in that he was from the Jimmy Cannons. You know, back in the 50s, Jimmy Cannon would come and he was a sports writer, and he had a lot of power because he wrote these insightful pieces about players. But he also had a way of mythologizing the players, you know, like Mantle and DiMaggio. These guys were kings. Dick Young was from his school. He was for lack of a better expression, let's say a blue collar writer for Blue Collar New York, and he was covering them, the players, and telling more about their lives. Now he wasn't really he was still a mythology builder, but he was starting to get into more than just the game. You know, one of the things that was happening in newspapers back then was you started having morning editions and afternoon editions. So the morning edition guys would cover the scores, and the afternoon edition needed something else to write about because the scores were already covered. Well, Dick Young kind of was the passed the baton from Jimmy Cannon to a group of sports writers called the Chipmunks. Now, that's an informal name, but these are guys like Phil Pepe, Stan Isaacs. Those are the guys who were the afternoon writers who really started writing more about the personal lives of the players. This is something that never really came out before if you were a fan in the 60s, to find out what these guys were doing at home, to find out things that were happening off the field. But they were looking for stories. They needed to fill the paper. And that, of course, really paved the way for Jim Bouton to come along and start telling stuff that was happening off the field, but it was stuff that was a little more juicy, so to speak. You know, it wasn't as harmless as what those guys were writing. But what was interesting about it is that what made Dick Young an interesting character is he was kind of, in my mind, the pivot from one to the other. You know, he kind of took the baton from Jimmy Cannon and passed it off to the Chipmunks. I don't know if he weren't there, whether or not that move would have been made as smoothly.
One of the things I like about this book is it's not only about things serious, but also it has some very, very funny stories. And I've always said that I think baseball, more than any other sport, lends itself to great sports stories. And one of the examples you have is about the 1965 World Series and about Sandy Koufax. I'll let you tell the story.
Well, Koufax, you know, the interesting thing about that story with Koufax is that he didn't want to pitch because it was Yom Kippur. So he said, I'm not going to pitch in the World Series because it's a holy day, and he was Jewish. But he was not a really religious guy. He just felt, I don't pitch on Yom Kippur. So one of the things we talk about in the book, which is not the story I'm sure you're referring to, but is that to this day, rabbis, we interviewed rabbis for the book, and they said to this day, children come in when they're getting bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, and they say that one of the most important Jewish role models they have in life, one of the top three people, is Sandy Koufax to this day. And he had no idea of the statements he was making and that ending up for the entire community when he said, I'm not going to pitch on Yom Kippur. So that really had lasting effect on society and Jewish society. But he didn't pitch. So Don Drysdale took the ball that day, and he goes out and he gets shellacked. So Walt Alston comes out to the mound to take Don Drysdale out because he's not getting hit, and because he's getting hit. And Drysdale looks at him and says, I bet right now you wish I was Jewish too.
Any other stories in this book that kind of leave you chuckling today, even when you think about them?
Well, a ton of them, but I'll tell you one story that I was thinking about before when we were talking about Dick Young. Is that there was a writer, Joe Tremble, who was a sports beat writer who was covering the World Series when Don Larson, 56, when Don Larson throws the perfect game. And he's got to get a story out right away. This is when there were just the morning writers. We spoke about morning and afternoon writers, but he's got to get something out right away because it's going to be in the morning edition, the next morning edition. And he's stumped. He's looking at it. He's got a deadline. The clock is ticking. And somebody just pitched a perfect game in the World Series. This was an unbelievably big moment that was handed to him, and he froze, and he couldn't come up with anything. And he turns to somebody, and he says, get me Dick Young. And Dick Young comes over. This is, you know, Young was not a veteran at this point, but he was like a cool customer. And Tremble looks at him and says, I'm stuck. So Young says, all right, give me the typewriter. Sits down, and he hammers out one sentence. And when Tremble looks at the sentence, he says, okay, I got it from here. Don't worry. Your work here is done. And the sentence Dick Young hammered out on that typewriter was, today, the imperfect man pitched a perfect game. And that was the line that set Tremble off. And Tremble won a lot of awards for that story. And Dick Young never said anything. In fact, Tremble was retiring and Dick Young was there, Tremble says, you know, I have to admit something that I never admitted to anybody else. And he tells the story. I won many awards for this, but Dick Young gave me the first line. He said, but I've never told anybody that story. And what makes me love Dick Young so much is that he never told anybody that story either.
I'm also interested in the integration of baseball because I was a youngster growing up in Washington, D.C., and Calvin Griffith was the owner of the Washington Senators at that time. And he was not a very tolerant or open-minded man, and there were a lot of owners that were like that. So as the integration of baseball came along, I think they went kicking and screaming, some of those owners in baseball.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Calvin Griffith. I mean, he moved the Senators to Minnesota. They became the Minnesota Twins, but the reason that he moved them out there was because he wanted to move where the demographics were whiter. So he took his team. He just upped and left. What's interesting in the book is that we talk about in 1966 how the Milwaukee Braves came to Atlanta because Andrew Young and others, Atlanta civil rights leaders and the mayor of Atlanta, Ivan Allen, were trying to build an integrated city from the top down. And they said, what we need to legitimize this is a baseball team and a stadium because that's when you're really on the map. And they had to woo Hank Aaron and the Braves to Atlanta, and Aaron didn't want anything to do with the South. He had grown up in the South. He had suffered enough as a black man in the South. But he came, and that ended up really legitimizing the city. And what's interesting is that now, this season, Atlanta is moving out of that stadium, and they're moving to a white suburb, Cobb County. I'm not saying it's for the same reasons as Calvin Griffith. I mean, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. But it is interesting that the very reason the team came there in 1966, I guess those reasons don't matter as much anymore, or maybe time has passed, but for whatever reason, they're now moving out to Cobb County. So whatever Andrew Young had done is kind of being erased now.
We have a little bit over 2 minutes left. And the issue of race also touched other sports as well, such as football, because the Washington Redskins were described as having the team colors of burgundy, gold, and Caucasian. And I think about the issue even today about the use of the word Redskins, and I just shake my head.
Well, yeah. I mean, and also now Rob Manfred just came out, I think it was last night, and was talking about the Cleveland Indians insignia too,
mm-hmm.
and the it has the Native American there, but it's a very stereotypical image. I forget what they call it. They have a name for it.
Well, let me interject this. I had a discussion about this sort of thing on the show one night, and a woman called me from Milwaukee, and she mm-hmm. said, "I'm part Native American," and she said, "I just want everybody to know, how do I describe to my daughter that we don't look like the Cleveland Indians caricature?"
Right. Exactly. Exactly right. And yet, there's still a struggle over it. So all these years later, that's one of the interesting, I have to say, that was one of the most interesting things about researching and writing this book, is how many of the issues. We were talking about Atlanta coming into and building their stadium, but there's so many issues, even with race and civil rights, that are still around today. It's amazing to read what was going on in the 60s and to see so many of the same things popping up now. It felt very topical, even though we were writing something that was 50 years old.
And we only have a minute left, but what do you want people to take away from this book, John?
Well, I think that there's a lot of people in that book that deserve a lot more credit than they ever got. I think that Marvin Miller certainly belongs in the Hall of Fame. He turned the game on its ear, and I don't think he ever got the recognition he deserved. And I think a guy like Jim Boughton, who came along and wrote what is now that the New York Public Library calls one of the 100 greatest books of the 20th century, most influential books of the 20th century, is still ostracized to some degree from Major League Baseball for writing this book 50 years ago. But look at what he paved for other people. So I think a lot of things that went on in the 60s and the people and the characters involved, people today, fans today, don't realize that what they're looking at is a result of the stands that people like Kurt Flood took and the risks that Jim Boughton took and the hard sweat that Marvin Miller put into the game. This is the fruits of their labor, what we're watching now.
John, congratulations to you and Wheezy. It's an outstanding book. I'm looking forward to reading it from cover to cover because I know your work, and this is just another aspect of it, and it's just an outstanding book. Thanks a lot for joining
you,
us. John Florio with us. John Florio with us, and the name of the book is called One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. I urge you to read and check this book out. We continue with more of You and Sports Byline.